around the springtime every year, and the cutoff for that list has gone up and up and up. But to get to the stratosphere is really rare company.
But you make an interesting point about the longevity of sports people's earnings power. Can we expect Ronaldo, Messi and all to actually earn more in the years after they quit playing the game?
I mean, it's certainly possible. When you talk about guys like Ronaldo, Messi, and some of these really high-earning soccer players, they have incredibly strong off-the-field commercial brands. You know, Ronaldo has more than a billion followers on social media across all platforms. He's one of the most marketable athletes, and he's also one of the most globally recognized athletes. And Messi's no slouch either. You know, like, these guys are global brands. It would be my prediction that they would continue to maintain their star power even into retirement. But we're not quite there yet. It seems like both of them still want to keep their boots on for quite some time.
You're absolutely right. The way Ronaldo's going, it may be several years before we're talking about retirement. Justin Birnbaum from Forbes, thank you so much for joining us on The Times at One. That's pretty much it for this week. Aisha Hazarika's here from 1 o'clock tomorrow. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Rob Boyden was pressing the buttons. And on The Times Radio next week, it's Danny Finkelstein. Right now, we're going to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Stephen, and a warm welcome back to the beautiful sunshine of Cheltenham. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4 from the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
And coming up on our programme today, amongst the books, we're going to give you the very latest on the China spy scandal that is engulfing this government. We'll find out why spending on peace initiatives has fallen significantly, why the Chancellor looks an awful lot more likely to raise taxes in next month's budget. And from 3:30, we go live on stage with Penny Lancaster.
Yep, who is the nation's most famous special constable, and she's got other stuff on her CV as well. So Penny with us live after 3:30. Let's start with the news at 2. Here's Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you. The Director General of MI5 has spoken about his frustration at the collapse of charges against two men accused of spying for China. Sir Ken McCallum has revealed a new spying plot by Beijing has been disrupted in the past week.
In this new era, with multiple overlapping threats on an unprecedented scale, we need to up our game. We can't rely solely on investigating and disrupting. Together we have to ensure that the UK is a hard target. We want our adversaries to think twice before acting against us.
The Director General also revealed his agency has seen a 35% increase in the number of individuals it's investigating over state-based threats. This morning, MPs announced a formal inquiry into the China spying case. In an urgent question in Parliament, the government says the decision to drop charges was that of the Crown Prosecution Service alone. It has revealed key witness statements, including from the Deputy National Security Advisor, which described the espionage threat from China. Chris Ward, the Parliamentary Secretary for the Cabinet Office, gave this statement to MPs.
Mr. Speaker, it is clear from this evidence, which all can now see, that the DNSA took significant strides to articulate the threat from China in support of the prosecution. The decision to proceed, as the Prime Minister made clear yesterday, was taken purely by the CPS. It is also clear that the three statements are constrained by the position of the Conservative government on China at the time of the alleged offences.
The Conservatives say that the witness statement included parts of the Labour manifesto. A prominent economic think tank says the Chancellor may need to raise £40 billion in taxes in her budget to avoid coming back for more next year. The Institute for Fiscal Studies is warning of fiscal Groundhog Day if Rachel Reeves doesn't make big tax rises or spending cuts. The Times' economics correspondent Jack Barnett says there are some taxes they do not recommend, though.
What they were doing was warning that she shouldn't be looking to increase taxes, which could be inflationary. So that could be things like increasing VAT, and also going back to businesses and asking them to cough up a bit more money for national insurance contributions. The Bank of England specifically said that payroll tax increase has actually prevented inflation from falling as quickly as they thought it was going to be.
The Chancellor has suggested some taxes will go up next month. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says it has received 30 bodies of Palestinians from Israel, taking the total received to 120 since the ceasefire on Friday. The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, says his country will achieve all its war goals despite the peace deal. And the Times can reveal the UK has ended its near two-year spying flight over Gaza to locate hostages held by Hamas. The Church of England's bishops have stopped planning for separate blessing services for same-sex couples. Conservative members warn that separate services would look too much like weddings and go against the official stance that marriage is between a man and a woman. Blessings can still take place within regular church services. And the Lord Speaker, Lord McFall, is stepping down early. The 81-year-old is taking more time to support his wife Joan, who has Parkinson's. An election to replace him as the House of Lords presiding officer was due to be held next July, but he will now leave the role at the start of February. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
And welcome to the epicentre of the civilised world, the Cheltenham Literature Festival. It's in the very heart of England, isn't it, Fee? We're here until 4 o'clock. We had the most beautiful journey on the train down from London because it's just peak autumn, isn't it, at the moment? And everything looked absolutely gorgeous.
I'd dispute it being peak autumn. Oh? I think it's on its way to being peak, so you've all got right. The gentle turning of the colours.
But it was still absolutely glorious, and you find ourselves now in Times Square. Can you see what's happened there? It's where we're broadcasting from. It's like a massive greenhouse, but it's got a wine bar as well, and it's got Sudoku, it's got Quizzle, it's got crosswords, it's got flapjacks, it's got everything that Middle England needs,
everything,
Jane,
for the Times reader, and everything for us.
We are catered for.
We so are. So our big guest after 3:30 is Penny Lancaster. Now, she's written a memoir called Someone Like Me, Lessons in Life, Love and Staying True. She was a model. She is a special constable. I think she's still doing regular shifts as a special constable, isn't she? And it's something that she got into courtesy of a TV reality show that she took part in. And then she kind of got the bug, but she properly puts herself out there. She puts her helmet on and she goes amongst the crowds, and it's not always easy.
She's done all of the training, and I was interested to read in the book that of everybody who went through the training, only three of the group, I think of a dozen or so people, did graduate. So she was top of her class. But she's got lots of things to talk about. She had really severe dyslexia as a child, completely unrecognised. And also, you know, she did make quite a lot of her life and her career about her looks when she was a younger woman. Mm. So she went to a college of fashion and she trained to be a model and then a photographer. But there has been for her a darker side to that beauty. Yeah. So we have an awful lot to talk to Penny Lancaster about. And also, she's got this boyfriend hanging around in the background, Jane, but I don't know whether or not we'll have time to talk about him.
He's some sort of popular crooner, isn't he?
I think he is. I'm not sure. So we'll just see whether we get round to that.
It's Rod Stewart, as a course, you know. So Penny with us. She's a loose woman, but I understand that she certainly arrived on time, in good time.
We can only ever hope to be.
Yes, in my ruddy dreams. We are also keeping you in touch with the big news stories of the day, of course, and in fact one of our guests this afternoon is the journalist Duncan Gardam, who's done great work over the years on espionage matters, and he's going to tell us exactly what he thinks about what's going on in the Chinese spying story, or the China spying story. That's shortly here on Times Radio. But first, let's get stuck into the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. What's at number three?
Ricky Hatton, the cause of champion boxer's death given at inquest. The 46-year-old was found at home by his manager in Hyde, Greater Manchester, on the 14th of September. And today, a coroner's court has been told that he had taken his own life. The second most read story, Arctur Trump. President unveils Washington, D.C. monument plan. The arch marking the USA's 250th anniversary would be nestled in a roundabout near the Arlington Memorial Bridge. And the most read piece on the Times website is one that Jane delved into herself on the train on the way here. What is that?
Well, it's the most Timesy story of all times.
country house prices plummet as property market slows down. The Times property team says that rural areas are a happy hunting ground for buyers after a bargain. And if you look online, you can see just how far prices have fallen where you live. Now, you can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. Why not treat yourself and get one? Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
It's 8 minutes past two. So we are live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. And if you feel like your brain needs a perk up, if you need to stack up some nuggets of wisdom to see you through the darkening days of winter, and if you want to enjoy a fabulous food court, very polite queuing, and a whole host of restaurants and shops and elegant Georgian colonnades just minutes from the festival site, well, get your Middle England butt here. The festival is sponsored by The Times and Sunday Times, and Jeremy Griffin is the executive editor. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello.
How are you enjoying festival so far?
I'm absolutely loving it. Absolutely loving it. I mean, for all the reasons that you said, we're here, you know, in a beautiful town, in a beautiful square in the middle of the town. There are children outside talking about books. I can hear the buzz among them. We're in an interesting tent with a range of temperature fluctuations that we can experience at any point.
You're doing well, because you've got quite a tweedy jacket on there, Jeremy. So it's quite hot.
It's part of the uniform, to be honest with you. So that's why I'm wearing this. But yes, the jacket might get removed a bit later on.
This year's festival lineup is superb. It always is, isn't it? And you've been involved in a Royals kind of discussion this morning that sounded quite intriguing, actually.
Yeah, it was very intriguing. Yeah, so the Times and the Sunday Times put on various events throughout the course of the 10 days at the festival. I work very closely with the festival programme team down here. And one of the events that we did was reporting the Royals, which took place at the town hall this morning in front of several hundred people who came in to see us. And I moderated that. I chaired it. I was there with Kate Mansey, who was the Royal Editor of the Times, and Roya Nicker, who you know well, the Royal Editor of the Sunday Times as well. And the general premise was, what's it like reporting the Royals? You know, what do you want to know about the royal family? What do you want us to tell you about the royal family? Which is great, but as so often happens with these events, news crept up. Well, it didn't really creep up. It basically came up and ambushed us over the last few days, but particularly last night as well. So we had the release of the first tranche of Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir, which made various accusations about Andrew and his entitlement towards her. So we spoke quite a lot about that at the event. We spoke a lot about Andrew's conduct, the allegations against him, what the king should do about him. We also spoke about Harry. And what I found is that, you know, the people who come to this festival and come to these events are totally plugged in. There's nothing you can't tell them that they don't already know about the royal family. But they do enjoy debating them with you. So we had some very interesting questions. And there wasn't a lot of love in the room for Andrew, I can tell you that, which probably won't be that surprising. What I found a little bit more surprising is there wasn't a lot of love in the room for Harry. I thought that, I know there are mixed views about Harry, but I asked the question about whether they would be happy for him to come back to the country. Barely anyone said they would.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Yeah, but maybe that's the kind of peaking feeling towards Harry now. It could change at any time. It seems to depend on Netflix series, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't like lumping Andrew and Harry together.
No,
because I mean, nothing on the scale
Of course. I think they were just... So the context of that was the king took over 3 years ago. He's had a rough time, let's face it, because he's been very ill. He's undergoing weekly chemotherapy sessions. And around him, various strands of his family are struggling as well. Not only has his daughter-in-law been very ill, not only is his son getting used to the idea that he'll be king probably, I don't want to be crass, but probably sooner than he expected to be. But his brother, who he thought he'd kind of, you know, put to bed, if that's not a bad pun, still the news keeps leaking out about him. And then separately, he's got his own sort of catastrophe at close hand with his relationship with his son, the fact that his son has moved to the other side of the world, the fact that every time he comes back to the country there's a row about something. And so we didn't lump them together in the sense that obviously they're completely different characters.
I'm not accusing you.
No, but just
members of the public have the maybe think they are as bad as each other, which I just don't I'm not buying into that.
No, I think they're just fed up with them both rather than thinking they're on a similar level.
So tell us about other things that you have enjoyed at the festival and that we should note for people who are coming to the festival.
Okay, so things so far, the thing about a festival, especially when a newspaper or newspaper sponsors it basically becomes, you've got all your rock star authors who come along and do their books, and that's great and people love that, but also it's a chance to meet people and kind of bring the newspaper to event life, if you like. It's like the pages of a newspaper. So I've done events. I've done a royal event today. We've done loads of current affairs. We had the Times debate last Saturday, which debated making Britain great again. How can we find our confidence in the world again? That was with Sir Jeremy Hunt, Trevor Phillips, our own John Pienaar chaired that. That was very well attended. I did an event with Mike Atherton on Saturday, which had 1,200 people in, about the Ashes. So we've sort of done news, foreign news, politics, sport, royals. So it is very much like bringing a newspaper to life. So I've enjoyed all of those. They've had great crowds. Over the course of the next few days, well, I'm not saying this because I'm doing it, but you can have breakfast with me tomorrow, if you like, over at the Queen's Hotel, which is just around the corner from where we are in Montpellier Square, where we'll be digesting the our breakfast probably, but also the news from the previous 24 hours as well. So we'll be doing a review of the papers and talking about current affairs there. What else? There's an event tomorrow with Christina Lamb, the Sunday Times foreign correspondent, decorated foreign correspondent, on Afghanistan's free press, in which she'll be discussing the struggles, if you like, now that we're back into the Taliban over in Afghanistan, of trying to build a free press and the voice that's given to, you know, people in that country. Then we've got later on tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the Town Hall. This would be a cracker. So we've got Jason Cowley, Sunday Times columnist, former editor of the New Statesman, on stage with Fraser Nelson, Times columnist, former editor of the Spectator, and they're going to be moderated by Rosie Wright, who of course is very familiar to Times Radio listeners, and that will be basically all about where we are in politics at the moment. And there couldn't be more interesting time to discuss that, and also ask, you know, how does Keir Starmer get out of the you know, the predicament that he's in at the moment as well. And then there are loads of other events over the next few days. There's Private Eye Live at the Times and Sunday Times Forum. That's tomorrow as well, 6 o'clock, with Ian Hislop and his crew. Jens Stoltenberg, the former leader of NATO, will be here with us, also in the forum on Saturday at 2:30. He'll be talking to Robin Niblett, the foreign affairs expert, about, obviously about where we are in the world at the moment and Russia and all those other things. And then there was one other thing I was going to mention as well, which I know I'm going to mention, because I've got a post-it note on this page. Oh, here we are, yeah. On Sunday, which would be the last day of the festival, we've got the Sunday Times Culture interview, which will involve people like Richard Curtis, Lenny Henry, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Darcy Bustle, so really good names for that. That's at the Times and Sunday Times Forum from 3:30. And then at 4 o'clock at Nook on Five, which you may know, ladies, it's a beautiful restaurant on the corner of Imperial Square in Cheltenham, so just around the corner from where we are now. Giles Corran has no idea. He brings his podcast to life over a meal at Nook on Five with his wife, Esther Walker, which should be a lot of fun and delicious at the same time.
A combination that those last two events sounds like the next year's lineup for Celebrity Traitors, doesn't it? You got all the names and then some. Jeremy, lovely to see you here. Well done keeping the jacket on as the temperature rises in the Times Square greenhouse. How long will we last? It's 15 minutes past two. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
What will those witness statements from the China spy case do to help Keir Starmer? We'll get reaction from political experts such as Caroline Wheeler, the Sunday Times political editor, and the communications advisor Joe Tanner. And our newsmaker interview is with Dr. James Aidley, who was the coroner for both Nicola Bully and Jay Slater, two people whose deaths were surrounded by misinformation. He'll talk about the truth behind conspiracy theories.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage. Roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SEG tariff.
They're bubbly. They're fuzzy.
And they're ruddy delicious!
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most, without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 19 minutes past two. Now, if you were listening to Jeremy and you were very, very intrigued by that royal chat he'd had earlier in the day with Kate Mansey and Roy Onika, the good news is that you can hear it yourself if you weren't able to be at that session in Cheltenham. You can listen to the Royals podcast, so the edition that drops tomorrow on the Times Radio app and indeed wherever you get your podcasts from will be everything that happened this morning at that session. I think I'm going to listen to that. Sounds rather good.
It does sound good. And yeah. Thank you, sister, because I think I was meant to say that at the end of the interview with Jeremy, but I hate hastened the ending of that, and I apologise.
Now, there is a great new politics podcast as well from the Times and the Sunday Times. It is called The State of It, and it features political editor Stephen Swinford and Caroline Wheeler, along with Patrick Maguire, the chief political commentator, and Gabriel Pogrand, Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times. They will bring you the inside story from the coalface of British politics, and you can find it on YouTube and on all the usual podcast platforms. It is called The State of It. Make sure you're a part of that. Now, the big news story of the day, the head of MI5 says a plot directed by China was thwarted in the last week. In a speech about threats facing the UK, Ken McCallum also said he was frustrated at the collapse of the trial of two British men accused of spying for China.
First thing I'd like to say on that one is how proud I am of my teams, who once again had detected threats to national security and intervened and successfully disrupted threats. That's what MI5's job is, and I'm proud of the way that we did so in this case and in many others. Obviously, it is even better for us if in cases where we create a disruptive effect, if we can ensure that disruptive effect really endures and ideally creates some additional deterrent effect. And criminal prosecutions typically are the very best way of doing that. That's very often what we and the police together do across our casework, countering terrorism and countering state threats. So, of course, our preference always is to effect the most enduring disruption we can when prosecutions and convictions happen. That's great. So, yes, we are frustrated when those things don't happen. Like, this is not unique. There are sometimes reasons why prosecutions don't work. But the key thing for us to do is to disrupt threats, and that's what we've done.
That's the voice of Ken McCallum, Director General of MI5. Well, senior parliamentarians on the Joint Committee on the State Security Strategy say they'll investigate the dropping of the China spying case. The Cabinet Office Minister Chris Ward told MPs today the government was profoundly disappointed that prosecution had been stopped.
It's clear from this evidence, which all can now see, that the DNSA took significant strides to articulate the threat from China in support of the prosecution. The decision to proceed, as the Prime Minister made clear yesterday, was taken purely by the CPS. It is also clear that the three statements are constrained by the position of the Conservative government on China at the time of the alleged offences. Mr Speaker, as the Prime Minister said yesterday and the Security Minister on Monday, this government's first priority will always be national security and keeping this country safe. We wanted this case to proceed. I'm sure all members of the House did, and I know you did too, Mr Speaker. We are all profoundly disappointed it did not.
So much disappointment. That's Chris Ward, the Cabinet Office Minister. Well, Duncan Gardam is a journalist who focuses on security matters. Can you tell us how disappointed you are, Duncan? Do you think this prosecution should have gone ahead?
That's a leading question, if ever I heard one. Look, I think the situation is complicated. So this was a trial that I was planning to cover. I had some doubt about whether they were going to secure a conviction. And I think that the reason for that is that first of all, our relationship with China is complicated. And secondly, it's the nature of the information that was allegedly being handed over. And so much of the information that Mr. Cash was sharing with Mr. Berry, and Mr. Berry was then allegedly sharing with the Chinese, was, if you like, political tittle-tattle. So we're not talking here about confidential documents being passed from inside Parliament or inside a national agency to the Chinese. We're talking about who's up, who's down, what's somebody's opinion on this trade deal or that trade deal. And I think that kind of material can be difficult to land in terms of prosecutions, because I think when you're looking at it as a member of the public, you might think, well, yeah, of course he's going to chat about that stuff to his mates, but he doesn't expect necessarily it to end up in the hands of a senior Chinese official in the intelligence business. And how it ended up there may be less than clear.
Yes, OK, and we need to make clear that both the men always denied the allegations against them. What about the attitude of Ken McCallum talking there about, I mean, I don't want to put a different spin on it, but he seemed to be saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the most important thing was that stuff was stopped. And if there was a prosecution and a successful prosecution afterwards, then that was all well and good. But the most important thing was to just stop bad things happening.
Yeah, that very much is what he was saying. After the speech that he gave today, which I was at, and then there was a question and answer which wasn't recorded, but we were allowed to take notes, he was making that point quite strongly about, of course, there's a frustration it didn't come to a successful prosecution from his standpoint. And as you rightly say, both of these individuals pleaded not guilty and maintained their innocence, and the cases were dropped against them. But the other point he was making was that MI5 are in the business of disrupting activity, and they're quite often doing that without prosecuting people. In fact, that was quite a mainstay of their operations until fairly recently. I've heard all sorts of stories about how they would do it, how they'd let somebody know, we know what you're doing and you need to stop doing it. And so it is relatively unusual. And until the National Security Act came in 2 years ago, it was very unusual to have that many prosecutions of individuals, and most of their work did involve other methods of disruption. Sometimes it would involve throwing a diplomat out of the country. Sometimes it would involve talking to somebody about the consequences of what they were doing from a professional standpoint. And there are many, many different ways. And sometimes, frankly, it involved a few tricks to let them know what they were up to.
Right. Where do you think we'll go in terms of the plans for the new Chinese so-called super embassy? Because that decision has been, I think, kicked down the road for another month or so. But what on earth is going to happen here? What do you think?
Well, I'm a security expert and not an expert in politics. Obviously, the two overlap. And I think Ken McCallum's comments again in his question and answer session this morning, was that he has given some advice to the government and he's not going to tell us what that advice was. We are in difficult territory here. And I think one of the things that the Director General was saying is, you know, it's very clear from their point of view, from MI5's point of view, where the line is. They want to stop people spying. But it is less clear where the policy and government lines are in terms of they have a trade relationship with China. And by they, I mean all of us, right? We're all using Chinese goods all the time. And that if we stop that relationship, everything becomes a lot more expensive in the UK. We can stop that relationship if we really want to, but it does come with consequences. There is a third aspect to this, if you like, and that's if China does something that actually stops that relationship themselves beyond what they're doing at the moment, which is spying and trying to acquire intellectual property and all sorts of secrets that we don't want them to have. Were they to invade Taiwan, that's a completely different situation, but it is one that our intelligence and I hope our government are thinking about fairly seriously.
But in the light of all this, there is no way that embassy can be approved, surely. And you'd have to imagine that the advice from MI5 is don't let it be built. It can't be anything else, can it?
Again, look, in danger of sort of bringing other arguments into this, and I don't want to be an apologist for the Chinese, because I know what it looks like is, okay, they're just going to build a huge nest of spies here. But actually, China already have an embassy. So the question is, do they want a bigger one, and what do they want to do in that bigger embassy? And is it more spying, or is it more trade work? And if we want the trade work, then we might want to give them a bigger embassy. I know my personal views on this are I wouldn't be giving it to them, but
Right. Okay.
There may be some other considerations being in play here.
Yeah, I mean, there's always an element of pearl-clutching British outrage, isn't there, at the notion of people spying on us when we're almost certainly spying on them. Well, we are, aren't we?
We are very definitely spying on them and getting political tittle-tattle and doing all the same things that they're trying to do to us. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Duncan. That's the espionage and security expert journalist Duncan Gardam, Times Radio. The temperature... The temperature in Times Square, have you seen it?
What is it? 29 degrees.
It's a welcome return of high summer here in the square. I do regret wearing that heat tech vest. I may actually, although on the plus side, I could have lost half a stone by the time I get back to London.
That's very true. Yeah. I've got one of those all-in-one body suits on today, which I thought would see me through the day. I'm regretting that one too. Well, look, don't worry. We'll be naked by about 4 o'clock. Fun times, everybody. The economy is growing, but are you feeling more optimistic? Gosh, that's a link, isn't it? We're coming to you live from Cheltenham. Back in London, though, manning the news desk, it's Tom Noonan with the headlines.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The head of MI5 has spoken about his frustration that prosecutions weren't brought against two men accused of spying for China. Sir Ken McCallum says his agency has disrupted another Chinese espionage plot in the past week. MPs have announced a formal inquiry into the China spying case after the government released key witness statements. Former Director of Public Prosecutions Lord Ken MacDonald told Times Radio it's not clear why the Crown Prosecution Service dropped the charges.
His statements, on its own terms, amounted to an assertion that China was a threat to our national security. So in those circumstances, it's quite difficult to understand a decision not to prosecute, or a decision that the evidence somehow fell short of what was required for prosecution.
The CPS deemed the evidence did not show China was a threat to national security. An independent economic think tank says Rachel Reeves needs to raise £40 billion in her budget next month to avoid what it calls fiscal Groundhog Day. The Institute for Fiscal Studies says the Chancellor needs to make big tax rises or spending cuts, or she'll be forced to come back for more next year. A coroner has confirmed Ricky Hatton took his own life. The boxer was found at his home in Greater Manchester by his manager last month. And a judge has dismissed a bid to end the murder trial of a soldier over the deaths of two civilians on Bloody Sunday in 1972. He's admitted evidence from two former paratroopers. Soldier F denies the charges. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Stop. Listen. Chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket. £7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy. Eat. Digest. Good. Repeat. Get the deal. Believe in chicken.
KFC.
Until 9th of November. Subject to availability. Participating restaurants only. Excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry. There was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now, and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only things she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Hiya, I'm Mike, colleague here at Asda Pillsworth, and I've got some big news to share with you about all the incredible prices I've seen in store, so turn up the volume now.
Wowza, Mike. That's right, because Asda have got over 3,000 rollbacks across the store and online to help lower the cost of your weekly shop.
That's good, honest value.
That's Asda price. Selected stores and lines. Subject to availability. Excludes Asda Express and small stores. See asda.com/small stores.
Take advantage of the Kia Electric Car Allowance to drive the Kia EV3, this year's UK and World Car of the Year. Or the new EV4, the Times Electric Car of the Year 2025, with a range of up to 388 miles. Get up to £3,750 towards your PCP finance deposit contribution and 3.9% APR representative until the 16th of December. Search the Kia Electric Car Allowance today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Range based on test conditions and may vary. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
We're down to a balmy 28.3 degrees in Times Square at Cheltenham. So if you'd like to come along to just enjoy a little Indian summer, maybe lose some weight.
Cheaper than a cruise.
Then you'll be very welcome indeed. Lots of people have joined us in the audience here and they're having some very nice little drinkies. Are you going to have a glass of wine? Would that be wise?
Not before. Not pre-Penny, I don't think.
No,
I don't get something for the train.
Okay, Penny Lancaster is going to be our guest, and that's going to be live on stage in the Forum from 3:30 this afternoon, and it'd be lovely if you could join us for that as well. Half an hour of that interview will go out live on Times Radio. The rest will be heard live in the auditorium and then go on our podcast off-air later as well. Is everybody clear about that? I'm basically saying it out loud because I'm not very clear myself. Callum has swapped places with us, and we were talking to Callum McDonald, who was here for Times Radio over the last couple of days, but he's zoomed back to London and he's standing in for John Pienaar this afternoon. Hello, Callum.
Oh, hello, Fee. Sorry, you caught me off guard. I was just adjusting the air conditioning in the studio. It's very cool in here, really.
Don't.
Icy, even.
Don't. 28.1 now.
Oh, my life. That is hot. It'll do the red wine good, maybe, from the wine bar that you're, what, 6 feet away
everybody's
from?
Everybody's having white wine.
Oh, are
everyone's
they?
Having white wine, actually.
Nice chilled wine.
It's that kind of a crowd.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says.
Fair.
What's on your programme today? Because it's a very, very busy developing news day, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. As you've been reflecting already this afternoon on the Chinese spy trial saga that continues really today, we'll be reflecting the latest developments to you on Drive After 4 o'clock, because it is moving quickly. I think the latest thing to sort of flag is this interjection from the head of MI5, Sir Ken McCallum, saying that Chinese state operatives present a daily national security threat to the UK. So he's given a speech in which he actually said that MI5 had intervened to disrupt Chinese activity of national security concern in this past week. And so even as the controversy rages about the collapse of the Chinese spying case, we see in glorious technicolor the difficulties that the security services and politicians have in navigating China as a state and as an actor, and as an actor that has infiltrated the UK. So a couple of guests just to point you to That we'll be speaking to after 4 o'clock. Sir David Calvert-Smith, who was Director of Public Prosecutions for England and Wales. Of course, the battle is raging between politicians and the Crown Prosecution Service over who should really take responsibility for this. I think there's a kind of fundamental consideration here that appears to be clearer than ever, that actually neither side particularly, it would seem, wanted to pursue this case all the way through a trial. But we'll speak to Sir David about that. And then Sir Richard Dearlove, who is the former chief of MI6 as well. We'll put some of Ken McCallum's comments to him and see if there is a decent level of synchronisation. I suspect there will be. And just one other to tell you about as well, Fee, is Ruslan Stevanchuk, who is the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, who I had the great pleasure of meeting about an hour or so ago and recording an interview with. So you will hear from Speaker Stefanchuk after 4 o'clock, just 24 hours or so before President Zelensky of Ukraine shows up at the White House to meet with President Trump. Mr. Stefanchuk is totally fascinating. He is an absolutely gripping listen as well. He is very clear, as I think most Ukrainian politicians are, as to what they need at this moment in time. He is assertive about what President Trump needs to do. And, of course, we have asked him whether he will be putting his name to any nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize for one Donald Trump. You can hear his answer to that after 4 o'clock.
Thank you very much, Callum. Enjoy the air conditioning. Save some for us. Let's talk about money now. It is coming up to 21 minutes to three. The UK's economy grew by 0.3% over the summer, with the government admitting it feels stuck for many working people. It comes a day after the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, admitted she was considering tax increases as she tries to plug this estimated £22 billion hole in the public finances. She's been warned by think tanks that some tax increases could increase inflation after fears that last year's national insurance hike did just that. Professor Adrian Pabst is Deputy Director for Social and Political Economy at NIESR and joins me now. Can you just explain the acronym to us, please, Professor?
Absolutely. It's the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, founded in 1938 by Keynes and Beveridge, amongst others.
Thank you. That is a great pedigree. Tell us a little bit about what's driving this, albeit small, growth in the economy.
There's been some news in terms of manufacturing improved compared with the previous month in July, when we had some contraction, in fact. We've also seen that the impact of tariffs, the so-called Trump tariffs, the U.S. administration tariffs, has not been quite as big as initially feared. But that's helped the UK economy as well, and a little bit of business and consumer confidence returning.
And how do we compare to other countries? And does it matter how we compare to other countries?
Well, I mean, it matters in terms of attracting business and investment. But really, these are just monthly figures. I think we should never really attach too much importance. It's just a snapshot. What we really should be interested in is the trend growth. And trend growth is really still only just above 1%, which is low by both historical and international comparison. And the US is certainly growing faster, and some advanced economies are growing faster as well in terms of trend. So let's really look at the big picture rather than just at a monthly snapshot.
What would really change people's lives in terms of that big picture? If the government admits that actually most working people, and I'm actually just going to say people there, feel a little bit stuck, at what point would we really recognise that some growth in the economy was benefiting us?
No, that's exactly the question to ask, really, for the policy making community, and of course also for us who are trying to analyse the economy and come up with ideas. And I think the answer is wages are the single biggest driver of people's living standards. And then for those who don't work, of course, it also matters that benefits are rated in line with inflation so as to give them, more income. But really, it's about wages. And wages, in turn, require, productivity increases, which means we have to produce more with what we have. But that really means we need investment in technology and infrastructure and housing and transport so that we can produce more with the inputs and can pay people higher wages. Inflation is still high, and that's why people don't feel better off. Yes, wages are growing, which is very welcome and really important. But inflation at around about 4%, of course, really eats into those wage increases a lot. And we also know that, for instance, housing costs go up by a lot more than inflation. we know that food and energy tend to go up by more than the inflation rate. And that means that people, especially on low income, are really suffering. And so for them, even wage growth does not feel like an improvement in their living standards. So inflation,
and can we...
that's a big battle as well.
Sure. I apologise for the slight delay that we have on the line here, but I'll just try and keep my questions very brief. Are you optimistic?
Always optimistic about the potential. You know, the British economy has got lots of assets and, you know, there's the talent of the people above all. There's innovation. You know, there is relative stability, you know, compared with other parts of the world. You know, there's some fantastic institutions and so on. But I think it's really the strategy and the plan that we require. You know, the budget is so important, not just because there is a hole in the public finances. I mean, my organization, the National Institute, already in August said that, you know, we're looking at a shortfall of around 41 billion. So, you know, at the time, I'm afraid there were a lot of people, including in Westminster, who dismissed this. But it looks like this is really true. So we also need to face up to the hole we're in. We have to face up to the low growth, the low productivity, the stagnating living standards, and come up with this plan and strategy to get us out of this mess, frankly. And that's what we're expecting from any government, you know. And the budget is really an opportunity for the government to set out its plan, not just for 1 year, but really until the end of Parliament. How is it going to get up investment to pay people higher wages so their living standards can rise?
Sure. And if we consider some of the things that have already been run up the proverbial flagpole ahead of the budget, and we're still 6 weeks away from that, so perhaps new levies on bank profits, perhaps taxes on the wealthy, a mansion tax, maybe changing some of the ISA allowances, maybe taking away some of the tax-free pension allowance. In your opinion, which of those things, or do any of those things, really affect short-term change?
Well, you know, every budget has, a million small measures, and that's just the nature of it. And that's not the problem. The problem is that we're not going to be able to plug the hole and really do the things that the economy requires to grow if we're just going to be doing lots and lots of smaller tax changes. You know, we need to really think, you know, big. And that means, you know, you're going to have to consider some of the big taxes, whether it's VAT or corporation or income tax. And of those three, income tax is the least distortionary. So yes, it would be breaking the manifesto pledge, but it's also the best way of actually encouraging investment, of getting to a point where the public finances are stable, and of not distorting economic behavior, whether it's investment or consumption. And here's the point. The government will very likely announce that it cannot uprate the personal tax allowance in line with inflation. So it can't essentially, you know, give people a bit more of their money, because people will still be paying tax at 12,570, which is the allowance. They won't uprate the tax bands. It's also known as fiscal drag. It generates revenue, which is why the government needs to do this. But that's effectively like raising income tax, because people will be paying more income tax. So Yeah. Although the government is very unlikely to be able to meet its commitment on income tax, it might as well raise income tax. It's the least distortionary way of doing it.
It will cause a political howl, though, won't it? Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. That's Professor Adrian Pabst, who is Deputy Director for the Social and Political Economy at NIESR.
Now, there's no doubt about the big news story of the day. Senior MPs will investigate the sudden collapse of the case against two men accused of spying for China. We did already discuss that, of course, with the journalist Duncan Garden. But since that case was dropped, the government and the CPS have been playing the blame game, publicly accusing the other of being responsible. Well, who really is at fault? Did China get a free pass in order to secure a better trade deal? Today's episode of the Story podcast has been looking into this. Manveen Rana spoke to the Sunday Times political editor Caroline Wheeler, who was the journalist to break the story.
My fear is that people will try to make Dan Jarvis or Matthew Collins the scapegoat in this. And I think both of those eventualities would be a really poor outcome. I think Dan Jarvis is following orders. I doubt very much that even he knows the truth of what's happened. You know, the sense that I have from all the weeks and weeks and weeks of digging around in this story is that the information is very tightly held by a matter of a number of people. Similarly, I think with Matthew Collins, I mean, I think it's just not feasible that one man alone would take such a seismic decision that would lead to a collapse of a case with such serious national security implications. But, you know, I think the pressure does, you know, ratchet up now. It ratchets up on what Jonathan Powell knew. The problem with Jonathan Powell is that he is technically a special advisor, which means that he doesn't have to come before any of the committees. And my understanding is he will go before one of the committees, but it will be held in camera, which means that his evidence will not be made public,
right,
which will make it very difficult for anybody to scrutinise anything that he said. But it's actually pressure on the Prime Minister himself. At the end of the day, you know, again, people are saying it would be totally inconceivable that a decision of this magnitude did not cross the Prime Minister's desk.
Caroline, in all of this, a lot of the government trying to defend itself has relied on effectively undermining the reporting around the case. And a lot of that has come directly from you. How has that felt?
I think the thing that worries me more than anything else is that it's really important that we have a trusting relationship with governments, that we are able to put information to governments and get a response that we think is credible. I mean, just to explain to listeners, we don't publish things unless we have at least two sources on them. Often that can mean that it takes weeks and weeks and weeks to run a story. So it's very alarming, I think, when you get to a situation where effectively the government is calling you out and calling out your reporting and effectively accusing you of lying. We're going to end up in a situation where that relationship is going to break down, and that's not going to be good for them, it's not going to be good for us, and it's not going to be good for the public interest either, who have an absolute right to get to the bottom of what's happened in this case, because as we've been discussing, the ramifications of this are far too serious. You know, as the Speaker of the House of Commons, Lindsay Hoyle, has said, it basically hands China a sort of open invitation to spy on MPs in this country, because we're not prosecuting these two individuals. So it's an uncomfortable place to be.
Well, that is the voice of Caroline Wheeler, the Sunday Times political editor. She was talking there to Manveen Rana. And you can hear the full episode on today's The Story podcast, one story told in depth every day. It is available for free wherever you get your podcasts. Now, next on Times Radio, the incomparable Jane Mulcairns joins us to look ahead to this week's edition of The Times magazine, featuring Keira Knightley and a 64-year-old on a psychedelic trip, his first, as it turns out. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
In the ever-changing world of current affairs, nothing stands still. Times Radio Breakfast is your essential weekend briefing with incisive analysis on all the latest developments in politics, culture and entertainment. Plus, all the latest financial news with the Weekend Money Check. Times Radio Breakfast with Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 on Times Radio with Handelsbanken. Banking done differently since 1871. Find out why at handelsbanken.co.uk.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry, there was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only thing she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SEG tariff.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wickes local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wickes.co.uk.
Welcome back to Cheltenham. We're at Times Square at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. The door now propped open by a stool and conditions a little bit more bearable. People are quaffing wine, they're chatting with friends. Some people are occasionally making slightly resistant eye contact with us. But there's one bloke with his back to us just doing a Sudoku.
Well, I mean, that's fair enough. That's happened to me in my life before.
Yes, I'm not new to me either, it has to be said. Anyway, if you are in Cheltenham and you could get to the Literature Festival, it's probably still time to make it down here to enjoy Penny Lancaster live at the Forum. That's the place we're going to be at 3:30.
You'll have to get a wiggle on there.
You will have to get a wiggle, but it could be in the Cheltenham area. It's not unfeasible if you are. Let's go back to London and speak to Jane Mulkerins, who is Associate Editor of The Times magazine, and Jane can delight us with some of the goodies in the mag this Saturday. Let's start with superstar Keira Knightley. What's she talking about, Jane?
Hello, Jane and Fee. Hello, Cheltenham. Hello. So Keira Knightley is, as you say, on the cover this weekend. And, I mean, we know that the 90s and the noughties were pretty bad if you were a woman in the public eye. But, I mean, Keira Knightley went through it. I'd sort of forgotten before Catelyn interviewed her for us for this piece how incredibly young and incredibly famous she was. I mean, she was 17 when she starred not only in Bend It Like Beckham, but also in the Pirates of the Caribbean, in the first Pirates of the Caribbean. 17! And she says that, I mean, her life just changed overnight. She says, I remember waking up one day and there were 10 men outside my front door and they didn't leave for about 5 years. She would leave the house and they were photographers rather than anything else outside the house. And they'd shout whore and slut just to try and get a reaction out of her or her brother or her dad or whoever was with her. And Catelyn says to her, you know, is it surprising you didn't have a nervous breakdown? And Keira says, I did go mad. I just managed to hide it. She talks about the extraordinary lengths that she went to try to put off the photographers. She shuffled between two flats, but then they rented out the flat opposite both of them. She started wearing the same clothes every day. She had multiple sets of exactly the same clothes so that they wouldn't want to get pictures of her because it always looked the same. And she stopped walking.
I thought that was a good
tactic.
She
just stood still. It's bonkers.
Yeah.
Absolutely bonkers.
She also does make clear, it's an interesting interview, that she never, ever reads a word about herself. So Catelyn says, look, I'm going to make this a decent interview. Don't worry, we'll do something a bit different. She says, well, it won't matter because I just won't see it. And I think she means it nicely, that she just doesn't need it in her life. But now she has written a children's book, and we know that will get a reaction, won't it?
Well, totally. And Catelyn acknowledges that in this piece. She sort of says that the fact that she's written the children's book was met with groans in some circles. Somebody said to The Guardian, celebrities don't need any money or exposure, but plenty of genuine writers do. I don't think Keira Knightley will care, because obviously she won't read that either. And she does sound very genuine about her efforts. I mean, she's been really, really choosy about the work that she's done. You know, she's done sort of smaller roles, more theatre, more interesting shows, rather than those kind of great big, you know, blockbuster juggernauts like Pirates of the Caribbean. And on her 40th birthday, instead of going on a yacht somewhere, she did a metalworking course. So I do think that she has an actual creative vein.
Yes. No, she sounds very impressive. And so does her mother, who gave birth to Keira on a cork floor, which apparently
is
had
the
to
cork
be replaced.
Important to you? Would it have not been impressive if it was linoleum? Okay, I can't even say it. Linoleum.
It can be very porous, Jane. That's the problem, isn't it?
They might have had to replace a little bit of the cork.
Keira says they did. It was all her fault. But, I mean, she was a newborn baby, so you can't hold it against her. That's an interesting interview. And I also enjoyed hearing from the 64-year-old man who, in the interests of medical science and with the encouragement of his daughter, went on what sounded to me like a quite disturbing psychedelic trip. Can you just explain what this is all about?
Yes, this is a great piece. A man called Brandon Robshaw, who is he's a philosophy lecturer at UCL, and his daughter is a doctor who was studying effects of psilocybin, which is the active component in magic mushrooms, on the human brain. And she said, I mean, I don't know how you'd both respond if your children asked you to do this. Dad, can I experiment on you? But he went for it. He went for it. He let his daughter basically put him under, which involved wearing a sort of swimming cap covered in tiny holes. That in itself might put me off, lying in a reclining chair with a funny hat on fitted with iPhones and a black eye mask. And then basically she dosed him up. It does sound quite extraordinary. From clown's faces, fairground music, wolves. Yeah. He couldn't speak. He really went there. He said it was actually 4 hours of the trip while he was listening to ambient music. But at the end of it, he actually felt very positive about the trip. He said he loved his family more. He felt differently about his job. I mean, maybe we should all give it a go. And he says that he believes that as a husband, he's become less quarrelsome. I mean, if that isn't,
well, he does.
If that doesn't,
it does end by saying his wife didn't feel that the after effects had lingered all that long because a few weeks afterwards he was back to his old self. I'm very risk averse, Jane, and actually, it's the first description of a trip of this nature, or of any nature, I've ever read, and it didn't tempt me. It genuinely sounded frightening. And why is it that you'd conjure up clowns? Why are clowns such a universal feature of psychedelic adventuring? I just don't understand it.
I've read, is that really the first piece you've read about a trip like this?
Really?
Are you so scared of it that you won't even read about it, Jane Coffin?
I don't recall. Well, I suppose I don't recall reading a piece like this from the perspective of a novice who hadn't ever done it. So, I've read drug-fueled memoirs. Of course I have. I'm a woman of the world. but not from an academic, I'd rather drier, academic, sane, sober individual explaining what it was.
Who's doing it
like
for science, not fun?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why clowns are a universe. Maybe perhaps a listener could tell us why clowns seem to feature so heavily in psilocybin and other sort of trips. Having never done one, Jane, I can't say.
Well, Jane, exactly. And thank you very much. Mercifully, we're saved by the familiar theme music of Times Radio.
Yes, I've just been told the bed's running. Thank you, Felix.
There's lots to look forward to, as ever, some cracking pieces in the Times magazine this Saturday.
So many denials, which to believe? You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And it is now 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio, live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. 25.7 degrees, in case you're worrying. Coming up in the next hour, funding for peace and equality aid across the world has dropped since President Trump came back into office. We're going to talk to Dana Abed, worldwide strategist for gender rights and justice at Oxfam International. We'll have a sneak peek into what it's really like to be a ghostwriter, following calls for their greater recognition and acknowledgement. And our special guest, former model and TV personality Penny Lancaster, special constable as well, will be joining us here live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Let's get the latest news headlines with Tom Noonan.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The Director General of MI5 has spoken about his frustration that charges were dropped against two men accused of spying for China. Sir Ken McCallum says prosecutions are the most effective way to deter spying.
Our preference, always, is to effect the most enduring disruption we can when prosecutions and convictions happen. That's great. So yes, we are frustrated when those things don't happen. Like, this is not unique. There are sometimes reasons why prosecutions don't work. But the key thing for us to do is to disrupt threats, and that's what we've done.
MPs will hold a formal inquiry into the case after the government released witness statements which describe widespread Chinese espionage. Both men who were charged deny any wrongdoing. The Institute for Fiscal Studies has warned the Chancellor may need to raise about £40 billion in this autumn's budget to avoid having to do repeated tax rises year after year. Helen Miller, the director of the IFS, told Times Radio she's constrained by her own economic rule and that she will not use borrowing to cover day-to-day costs.
Rachel Reeves will have to choose whether she wants to just get back to the teeny tiny headroom she gave herself last year or do something bigger. And if she wants to do something bigger, it could, you know, you could be adding, you know, 10, 15, 20 billion to whatever consolidation she needs to do. So there is really a huge range of options here. But the big picture is, I expect that, and most people expect now, that Rachel Reeves will have to do some kind of fiscal consolidation, meaning spending cuts or tax rises.
The think tank says the Chancellor should think about doing something big to increase revenue to convince markets she will not return for a third round of tax rises. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says it's received 30 bodies of Palestinians from Israel, taking the total received to 120 since the ceasefire on Friday. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will achieve all its war goals despite the peace deal. Thousands of people are taking legal action against the pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson. They claim the company knowingly sold asbestos-contaminated talcum powder in the UK, which has caused them or family members to develop cancer. The firm insists the product is made from a naturally occurring mineral and denies it causes cancer. The French Prime Minister has survived two votes of no confidence this morning. Sébastien Cornu is the fifth PM of President Emmanuel Macron's second term, and he resigned after 26 days before being reappointed 4 days later. The Times' Paris correspondent Adam Sage says he's had to throw out President Macron's pension reforms in order to survive.
Le Cornu now hopes that by doing some kind of deal with the socialists, he has done that deal now over pensions. He hopes that that will secure him stability and the ability to ride out the rest of President Macron's second term, which is due to end in the spring of 2027.
And the former West Ham footballer Saeed Benrahma has been fined more than £12,000 after his dogs escaped from his home and attacked a golden retriever. The court heard the dogs were both XL bullies, the golden retriever needed vet treatment, and the owner suffered grazes to his arms and legs. For news when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
You join us here live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. It's 4 minutes past three. We are in Times Square. Can you see what they've done there? It's a great big greenhouse that's been erected in the centre of the grounds at the festival. And you can pop along, you can play some puzzles. They've got some Sudoku on the go, some quizzles, some crosswords, all in these very, very kind of modern digital consoles, haven't they, Jane?
That's right, Fee.
And there's a bar as well. So lots of people have come in for a little bit of day drinking, and we welcome that. We're looking at that enviously. And at 3:30, Jane and I, and we've worn sensible shoes for the occasion, we're going to hot-foot it over to the Forum, where we will be introducing Penny Lancaster live on stage, and we're going to talk about her memoir called Someone Like Me. In it, she details her life as a young model, which was not plain sailing at all, and we will also be talking about her work for the menopause, many charities that she supports. Dyslexia is one of those. She was severely dyslexic herself and had a terrible time at school because of it. And then we'll talk about the sunshine years of her life, which is definitely meeting Rod Stewart and bringing a very complicated blended family together. So we've got lots of stuff to talk to Penny about. If you're coming along to the Forum, you do have an opportunity to ask questions as well, and we will look forward to seeing you there.
Yep, looking forward to Penny very much. She is coming up just after 3:30. And actually, before that, you can hear a conversation with a ghostwriter, because there's been a lot of talk about ghostwriters, hasn't there? Penny does acknowledge her ghostwriter and thanks her very much for the effort.
She makes no secret at all that she has been aided and abetted in the writing of her book by the ghostwriter. She describes her as the brilliant Helena Drakakis. Thank you for putting up with my constant attention to detail, my habit of going off on a tangent and ensuring my voice came off the page. Sounds like someone I know, actually, that's weird. But there is plenty to talk about, because so many people, and what a place to be talking about ghostwriting as well, Jane, at the Premier Literary Festival of England. England for sure. So many people will come along and they'll pay very good money to hear an author talk. They will pay very good money for an author's book. But at the back of their minds is this feeling that maybe it's not their work at all. And you and I think that that practice might be coming to an end. There's a whir in the air, isn't there, about the need for honesty?
I think there needs to be a whir in the air. That ghostwriters work hard and they need to be acknowledged, and the best people do acknowledge them. So we'll talk about that in a moment or two, but first to the other news of the day. And funding for peace and equality initiatives worldwide has dropped by 7% in the last year as countries redirect cash into their militaries, this after the election of Donald Trump in the States. A new report from Oxfam says that women's organisations are being hit particularly hard. They're now getting less than half a cent of every dollar given in aid. The UK is among the countries cutting aid budgets, and that is despite warnings from people like Lord Dannett, the former head of the British Armed Forces, that aid cuts only end up increasing the pressure and burden on our troops. Let's talk to Dana Abed, who is worldwide strategist for gender rights and justice at Oxfam International. Dana, good afternoon. This is troubling, and for you it must be incredibly depressing.
Hi. Well, yes, thank you. It's not looking good. It's actually looking very grim, especially during October, now that we celebrate 25 years since the WPS, the Women, Peace and Security Resolution, has been signed. We can say that feminist-led peace hasn't failed. It has actually been betrayed. Like you've mentioned, military spending has risen by $1.5 trillion in 84 countries in 2024, while aid for gender equality and peace fell by 7%. So, yep, it's not looking good.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's quite a struggle, frankly, to defend that incredible amount of money being spent on defence. But, of course, some people would say there won't be rights for anybody if we live under the wrong sort of regime. And, therefore, we need to guard against the very real threats that are out there. And increased military spending is essential. What do you say to those people?
I don't think there's anything that justifies a conflict in the way that we've seen it in the past 2 years. We've seen a genocide unfolding in Gaza. We've seen a terrible war in the DRC and South Sudan, which are all case studies of our report that we've published today. And this is not justified in the sense that it's not only stopping peace, but it's also harming women and girls and their rights, who pay the highest price when it comes to conflict. Women are continuing to nurture shattered communities, shouldering most of their responsibility, and all of that without enough political space or financial backing to do so. We've also seen the highest number of women civilians being killed in 2024, and the numbers for 2025 are not out, but I don't think they're much more amazing, to be fair.
No. And I wonder if you could just give us some practical examples from the real lives of women in the toughest possible circumstances. I think women are particularly vulnerable, for example, when they go out looking for food, water and firewood.
That is true. But we've also seen gender-based violence being used as a weapon of war, including sexual assaults in DRC, in Palestine and South Sudan. So in active conflict zones, gender-based violence and sexually assaulting women is being used against them as weapon of war. For example, in OPT in Palestine, Israel's genocide on Gaza and the violent repression in the West Bank has caused years and decades of attacks on women and gender-based violence. In South Sudan, women's 35% political quota has not translated into genuine influence. In DRC, only 13% of parliamentary seats are held by women. So as you can see, women and girls pay the highest price in terms of the attacks that they get and how much they suffer and how much care they have to shelter and burden over the course of the conflict. And they're not at the same time offered space on the table, political participation, as well as political and financial backing to be able to have their voices heard.
Yes, I mean, it was really noticeable at the conference in Egypt at the beginning of this week. It seems a lifetime ago, but it was only the beginning of this week that the only female leader there present was Giorgia Meloni of Italy. I didn't see another female on that stage. Women have to be at the table for change to happen, don't they?
They have to be at the table for change to happen, and we have to prioritize what we call feminist-led peace and what that means. And that not only includes having more representation from females just for being women, but also from women from grassroots communities, women who are the people that are most affected in conflict zones. We need to see more of their and hear more of their voices on the tables in peace negotiations and peace deals. And that is also translated by the through the countries that ideally or on paper support women, peace and security and support feminist foreign policy, which are the same countries that also finance military and send weapons, etc. And those include Canada, yes, the US, the UK and France.
Yeah, I mean, the UK, what would you say about its commitment or lack of it to international aid right now?
So the UK is one of the countries that are introducing very deep cuts to overseas aid this year, with a 40% cut being restricted. They're introducing deep cuts to overseas aid, and they're having a 40% of their cut being redirected towards defense. So projects supporting women and girls have been particularly singled out for cuts by the government. And as the trend is with other countries, we're seeing a very high rise in their defense and military budget.
And where is the outcry? And I appreciate you're on the radio now talking about this, but this should be a topic for debate the length and breadth of the country. And I'm afraid the truth is, Dana, that it isn't really, that most people think, well, yes, I think it's entirely logical to spend more on defence. How do you change that mindset?
I think at the time, so I'm not from the UK, so I cannot speak on behalf of your country, but as an external observer, I can say that at the time when there is a very big rise in prices and cost of living and people are suffering to get by and the numbers of civilians killed across overseas is huge, and we're witnessing, like at the time of genocide, spending on military and defense is not justified in this way. But rather redirecting the budget towards public services, towards support of communities, and towards promoting feminist peace and peace globally is the way forward to ensure so many of the rights of people are being met.
I appreciate that there's terrible suffering going on in Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo and Gaza and the West Bank. But Afghanistan is also a glaring example of the most savage cruelty towards women and girls. What do you know about what's going on there?
I don't have a lot of information on Afghanistan as it's not directly included in our report, but we can also say, as the trend is being seen, a lot of countries have turned their backs on Afghanistan, and I assume it is also quite impacted by the rise of military spending and the cuts in aid globally. We're seeing a terrible situation for women and girls, with their spaces being restricted day after day, including their access to education and access to basic rights. And that is something that needs immediate attention.
It is interesting that the former head of the British Armed Forces has said that the cuts to the aid budget really can be counterproductive, because they do put additional pressure on troops who end up carrying out roles perhaps for which they're not trained, or they simply don't have the time to carry these roles out. What do you think of that?
I think cutting aid budgets is absolutely counterproductive, because it also stops the communities and countries from being able to have agency over what they want. So I think not only should we increase our aid budgets, but we should also do it in a way that is directly received by grassroots organizations on the ground, to allow some form of agency and independency to happen, instead of creating this aid dependency that continues for years and years. And when it stopped, we see that not only there is more conflict, but there are also more people in need, and which destabilizes the entire world, not just the countries that are cutting aid.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, Dana, thank you. Thank you very much for your time. Dana Abed is Worldwide Strategist for Gender Rights and Justice at Oxfam International.
That takes us to exactly 16 minutes past three. And coming up, we're going to explore the secret life of a ghostwriter. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SEG tariff.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Hiya, I'm Mike, colleague here at Asda Pillsworth, and I've got some big news to share with you about all the incredible prices I've seen in store. So turn up the volume now.
Wowza, Mike. That's right, because Asda have got over 3,000 rollbacks across the store and online to help lower the cost of your weekly shop.
That's good, honest value.
That's Asda price. Selected stores and lines. Subject to availability. Excludes Asda Express and small stores. See asda.com/small stores.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
19 minutes past three now, as we meander towards the festive season, you might find yourself in a well-known book retailer, perhaps even one here at Cheltenham, pondering which sports memoir to buy a difficult brother-in-law. The Society of Authors has called for stars and publishers, though, to acknowledge ghostwriters, who are often the ones behind celebrity books. It feels as if there is something in the air now, a desire for a bit more honesty about who's really done the work when a celebrity suddenly appears on a bestseller's list, or on a stage at a festival, like the one we're about to leap onto here. Well, with the ghost-written celebrity novel on the rise too, Claire Balding recently told us on our podcast and our show that she was having to stress in interviews that she had in fact written her own book. And this led to a listener called Leslie getting in touch, who works as a ghostwriter. And we asked Leslie what she made of it all.
I feel for authors like Claire. She's obviously a really talented writer herself. And I knew that she had written her memoir. So I knew that she would have written her book herself. And I feel for her that she has to kind of put her hands forward and say, this is actually my book. I've written these words myself. The work I have done here is my work. It shouldn't have to be that way. You know, I think that there, I think some of the hierarchy in publishing has kind of made ghostwriting into almost a dirty word in places when it really, really shouldn't be.
Leslie, can you tell us how you became one?
I've been a freelance copywriter for many, many years, and that's involved all kinds of different writing for all kinds of different platforms, including editing books and developmental editing of books, which kind of means that you're kind of involved in the structure of the book, So you're not just given a manuscript when it's finished and asked to edit it. And then a few years ago now, I published my only novel. That experience was wonderful in one way and not exactly what I had anticipated in another way. But I have a wonderful agent. She's a renowned ghostwriter in her own right as well. And maybe about 3 years ago, she asked me if I would consider ghostwriting someone's memoir. And I paused because I thought, well, first of all, my instinct was, oh, I couldn't do that. I can't do that. And someone did point out, if I was a man, I probably wouldn't have said that or wouldn't have thought that. And the second one was I still didn't really understand maybe the ethics behind ghostwriting. And anyway, my agent had a good talking to me and I kind of realised that, you know, there are so many people out there who have wonderful stories to tell who are not celebrities. They're ordinary people from ordinary walks of life and they have remarkable stories that they want that story to have a platform. You know, if I want to get a bit of plumbing done in my house, if I have an issue with my washing machine, I can't fix it myself because I'm useless at that kind of thing. I will hire a plumber or I'll hire a painter and decorator or I'll hire someone to assemble my flat pack furnishing for me. So what is the issue with someone who has a story to tell but can't put the words down themselves hiring a writer? So anyway, I agreed. And since then I have ghostwritten a few more memoirs and non-fiction books, and it has been the most rewarding time of my long and varied writing career. I love it.
It's such a good way of putting it. I think that's just such a fantastic analogy about why you need a certain talent in order to write, even if you've got a very good story to tell. But I wonder whether there's still a very distinct difference between ghostwriting somebody's life story, their memoir, and ghostwriting somebody's novel. Because presumably you're being asked to put quite a bit more of your own creativity into writing a novel for somebody. They don't have ownership of that story, do they?
Well, this is the kind of, I think, the conundrum with ghostwriting at the minute. I haven't ghostwritten a novel and I have never been asked to. And I don't know that I would be able to do that. There are so many really, really talented writers out there who do not get the opportunity to get their book into print, onto a bookshelf in a bookshop. And I would much rather that those writers are given the opportunity than a celebrity who already has a very valid and valued career in another sphere. And the last thing they need to do is really to say that they've written a novel that they haven't written.
Do you think, Leslie, that the reader is entitled to know? Because in fairness, sometimes if you bother to read the acknowledgements, you will see reference to someone who's helped the celebrity author along. But would you be happier if it actually said on the cover of a book by Barbara Starlett and insert name of ghostwriter who's won't have name recognition, but whose craft will therefore be publicly recognised? Would that be fairer?
I think in fiction, yes. I think in non-fiction, it's more prevalent for the ghostwriter to be mentioned somewhere, not on the cover of the book, but in, you know, quite prominently in the acknowledgements. And I also think that maybe there's maybe more of an understanding generally with readers that an acceptance that a lot of celebrity memoirs are ghostwritten, or at least that there is a co-writer or someone in the background helping with the kind of assembling of that book. But I think less so in fiction. And I mean, one of the most recent ones, I guess, that caused a lot of controversy was the Millie Bobby Brown book. I think once they acknowledged that, once the publisher acknowledged that, yes, Millie Bobby Brown did not write her book, then the ghostwriter was kind of brought into the picture and was acknowledged, and Millie Bobby Brown herself. I mean, I do love her. I felt for her. It's not her fault. And she received an awful lot of really quite vicious vitriol on social media from people, you know, who were kind of attacking her. And it wasn't her fault. I feel the fault lies at the ultimately with the publisher.
I remember that case of Millie Bobby Brown very well, because it's the first time that I can remember, Leslie, that a celebrity did openly say, actually, it's the work of this person over here. And that's just so telling, isn't it? Because presumably, and unless the celebrity involved does say publicly, it's the work of somebody else, the somebody else, the ghostwriter, has signed a contract, which means that they can never say, this is actually my work. Yeah. And all she was doing was just telling a truth that has been around in publishing for a very long time.
Yes, that's true. And I guess also as a ghostwriter, you know, you have to accept that that's, if you agree to write someone's book, whether it be fiction or nonfiction, and you sign a contract, then, and the contract states that, you know, you will not be named or recognised, but you're being paid a hefty fee for it. You know, I guess that's, you know, that's the payoff, isn't it?
It is, but I wonder whether people would still buy the books. I mean, Jane and I, you're absolutely right, after we've done interviews with some celebrities, many people who are involved with the world of ballroom dancing, you know, we feel fraudulent.
Picking that at random.
Just a random TV show, Leslie. But yeah. Jane and I feel fraudulent, don't we, that we're doing an interview
dirty
with somebody
about
a book that, as we always say, not only have they not written, they probably haven't read. And we don't really want to involve all of our listeners in that whole shebang. But that's the point. Would people still be buying the books if actually it had the star's name on the front, but underneath it clearly said, you know, work done by somebody else? That's what the publishers are dreading embracing, isn't it? Do you think that people would still want the books?
Well, I guess, I mean, I think they probably would, because it's going to be the celebrity that you're interviewing. So it's not going to be the ghostwriter that you're interviewing anyway. So the celebrity's still coming on talking about this book. And, you know, I think if they were kind of more open about the fact that the book was written with the help of a ghostwriter or entirely by a ghostwriter, but that they had a contribution to the story, I think people would still be intrigued enough to go out and buy it. But, you know, it goes back to that. Like, it goes back to my earlier comment. You know, there are so many. Why that ghostwriter is probably a really, really talented writer. But if that ghostwriter was to try and publish their own novel, it wouldn't get an iota of the attention than the book they have just ghostwritten for a huge celebrity.
That was ghostwriter Leslie Allen. So coming up, we are live on stage at the Cheltenham Literature Festival with the fabulous Penny Lancaster. And all of that will happen after the news with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The head of MI5 has expressed frustration at the collapse of the China spying case. Sir Ken McCallum has insisted he'll never back off from the challenge of China and revealed his agency disrupted a new Beijing spying plot in the last week. The security journalist Duncan Gardam says the Director General focused on other ways to counter the threat.
The other point he was making was that MI5 are in the business of disrupting activity, and they're quite often doing that without prosecuting people. In fact, that was quite a mainstay of their operations until fairly recently. I've heard all sorts of stories about how they would do it, how they'd let somebody know, we know what you're doing and you need to stop doing it.
MPs have announced a formal inquiry into the China spying case after the government released key witness statements. Those statements describe widespread Chinese espionage, despite the Crown Prosecution Service previously saying the charges were dropped against two men because the evidence did not describe China as a national security threat. An independent economic think tank says Rachel Reeves needs to raise £40 billion in her next budget to avoid what it calls fiscal Groundhog Day. The Institute for Fiscal Studies says the Chancellor needs to make big tax rises or spending cuts, or she'll be forced to make more next year. Nestlé has unveiled plans to cut around 16,000 jobs around the world over the next 2 years. The Kit Kat and Nescafe maker says it wants to automate more of its processes. It's thought that 7,500 of those job losses could come in the UK. A coroner has confirmed Ricky Hatton took his own life. The boxer was found at his home in Greater Manchester by his manager last month. And a judge has dismissed a bid to end the murder trial of a soldier over the deaths of two civilians on Bloody Sunday. He's admitted evidence from two former paratroopers in the case. Soldier F denies the murders in 1972. A verdict is expected next week. Now, we will hand you back to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover, live from the Cheltenham Literature Festival, on stage with Penny Lancaster.
We would like to welcome all Times Radio listeners to the forum in Cheltenham, just to prove we're live. Hello, audience. Hello. It's so lovely to see you all here today. Jane and I have hot-footed it from the news desk, the environment of our show, which we were attempting to do news in a greenhouse in Times Square. I think it was okay, Jane.
It was okay after the temperature went down to only 27 Celsius in that greenhouse. We had to prop the door open with a stool. Nobody wants to hear about our suffering. Everybody wants to see our guest this afternoon. Shall we bring her on?
I think we should. We are going to welcome our guest, and we're really delighted that she can be here today. Menopause campaigner, special constable, assault survivor, photographer, model, dyslexia awareness monitor, loose woman, and she's got a boyfriend. Can you all welcome... She's got a husband, hasn't she? Penny Lancaster. Yeah.
Woo!
Hello, everyone! Ta-da. From Glastonbury Festival to Cheltenham Festival. I feel very much at home, although this is very new to me. Thank you, ladies.
What? The literary world is new to you?
It is new to me. Yeah. Very new.
It must be very civilised compared to the rock and roll.
It's rather civilised. We can get you going, though, can't we?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't bank on it, Penny. It's not what Fee and I specialise in.
Actually, judging by the people who came to watch us do the news element of the show, you're all drunk.
It's that time of day, I think, isn't it?
Just incredible.
The champagne afternoon tea.
Yes, yeah. Why not? Mm. Penny, you're here to talk about Someone Like Me, which is your memoir. Our Times Radio listeners will just have heard a very interesting interview that we did with a listener who contacted our podcast called Leslie, who's also a ghostwriter. Because Jane and I interview lots of people, lots of our podcast audience listen to the interviews with authors, and we have started to become a little bit uncomfortable with being asked to interview celebrities who actually we know haven't written their book. But you are completely honest about the fact that to write your book, you enlisted the help of a ghostwriter who you call brilliant. So can you tell us about the decision to be very honest about it and actually what the process is?
Well, I'm honest all over, really. That's kind of like my signature thing. And I'm dyslexic. So when I was given the opportunity to write a book, I thought, first of all, I thought, I can't. And then I was asked to do the audio, and I was like, I can't. But in fact, you know, with the encouragement that I've had along the way with my parents, and then with Rod telling me that I've got something to give, and I've got experience and warmth and honesty, and I'm relatable. And so he said, give it a go, my darling. So I did get the great help of Helena, my ghostwriter, and we worked like thick as thieves. I wanted it to be very, very authentic. We sat for 4 or 5 hours at a time chatting about every detail of my life. And then she would go away and write a couple of chapters and ping them back to me. And we went back and forth and back and forth, changing. Even sometimes it was just a word that I didn't feel came off the page the right how I wanted it to. And she would often say, well, that's the word you use to describe that. And I said, I might have said that while we were chatting, but now I'm reading it, it feels different. Mm. So I often do interviews for newspapers, and I get to have copy approval, and I do a similar thing where I want it to sound as true to me as possible. Nothing taken out of context or twisted or turned around or fabricated. It has to be from the heart and the truth. So we worked painlessly, and, you know, I'm a stickler for detail. And
Did you drive her mad? I did drive her absolutely mad.
That's how the process went. And then that was every couple of chapters. And then right at the very end, we read through the entire thing front to back and still made changes. I was sitting there making notes because I know I could always probably go back and rewrite and add things that I've missed or thought I've forgotten about this or that. But I feel that this is the whole of me.
Yeah. Mm. And were you ever encouraged not to say that you had worked with somebody to write the book? Because that's what we're a bit intrigued by, the level that people are kind of slightly colluding in the industry.
Well, I think from what Helena had said to me is she has worked with people that have literally said, well, you write the book, you could just grab pieces from various interviews and get it done, and I'll just turn up and sign a. And I'm like, well, that's not being an author. That's not writing an authentic story about yourself. I wanted, and what's lovely is my girlfriends have said they feel like they've got me sitting on the sofa next to them chatting. They said it's like literally your voice. And you know, then I've did the audio version, which totally is my voice. And of course, that sounds more authentic because I have the emotion behind all the words. Mm. But I found it very interesting doing the audio, not only because I found it challenging being dyslexic. It took me a day longer than I'd been booked to do the job for. But I did feel like I was, at some points, reading someone else's story. Because in a sense, hence the title, Someone Like Me, it could have been about anybody's life. Because so many women in particular, and men supporting those women, have gone through so many of the things that I've gone through in life, whether it is bullying at school, whether it is coping with being undiagnosed with dyslexia. So many women, particularly my generation, and sadly it's still happening, are victim to crime, to sexual assaults, giving birth, IVF, menopause, all those things. I felt like this is a story that I'm feeling it's resonating with so many people because so many other people go through the same thing as me.
Did you ever think about leaving? I mean, particularly the sexual assault you suffered as a young woman from somebody in the...
Young girl.
Yeah, it's really important to acknowledge that. Thank you for making that clear. From somebody who was a lot older, somebody in a position of authority. You could have left that out. You could have danced around it. But in fact, you are right in there and you let us know exactly what happened. Just tell us a little bit about your decision-making, really, and whether or not you or Rod or anybody else who cared for you actually might have told you, Penny, you don't need to mention that.
There were a couple of topics that, particularly my mum and dad, because they said this is our story too.
Oh, Penny.
Well, Penny, that, of course, that's true.
Do you know what, sweetheart? The last thing that we wanted to do was upset you, and our audience is so blooming fantastic. So I tell you what, we'll talk about some other things and we'll come back to that.
I'm good at talking through tears, it's fine.
Are you sure?
Tell us about that then, if you don't mind.
Yeah, if there were some tissues, that would be useful.
Let's get tissues.
There we are, look.
Oh, look, great, thanks.
Former girl guide. I knew it would come in handy one day.
Well, it is one of those triggering subjects, but to be completely authentic.
Yeah, we got you.
Penny, you can take a beat. Don't worry about it.
Well, I entered into policing. So many people said, why the hell policing? Not just at your stage of your life, but where did that come from? And I'd had an incredible experience with a TV show, working with Cambridgeshire Police, working on the front line with regular officers as well as specials. And I didn't understand what specials were. And they said it's an incredible service that you'll be able to give to the community, volunteering your time, but the same powers as a regular. And I was like, So you work your regular job and then you give up your spare time. And I'm thinking, I think I've got a bit more spare time. Somewhere I'll find it. And so I did all the training and I passed out and went out on the beat. And it wasn't until I started writing the book and looking back at what I'd gone through in my life that I really understood why I ended up in policing, because I was that victim of crime. And those particular predators were never caught. There was no prosecution. So I felt like I needed to do something to protect others, because I fell victim and it didn't work out that great as far as finding the culprit. And I've kind of always gone through life like that. When I was bullied at school, I found the strength to get through it because my mum in particular would say, look at it from a different perspective. I know it's painful, darling. And I know it's horrible because it was the mental torture as well as physical. But you've got to understand that it's not just the pain that you're going through. You have to recognise that the bully is suffering in a strange way, because there must be something going on in their life as to why they feel the need to have to torture someone else. It lessens their burden and puts it on someone else. So it did make me reflect and think of all sorts of different situations from a different perspective. And I kind of went on and protected other people that I thought were being victims of bullying.
So tell us some of those stories, because they're absolutely lovely in the book. So you just get to the point where you think when you're at school one day, I'm not going to let this happen to somebody
to
else,
someone
the
else.
Stuff that's happened to me.
To tell someone us, like yeah. me.
So tell us what, what
yeah,
you
there
do.
Was there was a girlfriend, she was the same year as me, but she wasn't one of those popular ones. I wouldn't say I was necessarily popular. There was kind of the cool gang and then there was the clever clogs. I was somewhere in between, didn't really fit in anywhere. And there was this other girl that was in a similar space as me, but she wasn't as confident. I know being tall gave me confidence, even though that was one of the reasons I was picked on. But I guess my stature kind of gave me that impression to others. Whereas she was very short and timid, and she didn't feel like she had anything going for her. And when I saw she was being picked on, and it was the last day of school, and I heard the core gang were going to get eggs and flour and meet her outside the school gates at lunchtime and pelt her with the eggs and flour on her very last day. And I thought, I've suffered bullying for a few years now, and I've found the tools and the strength to deal with that. I don't think she will be able to survive through life with that at the end of the day, on the last day. So I grabbed her hand and I said, I'm going for lunch with you today, because I knew what was about to happen. I found the eggs and flour and I tried to hide it. I got caught hiding it. Not great. So I thought, right, we're both in for it now. Walked her to lunch. It was a bagel bakery. And the girls, the group of them, there was about five of them, swarmed towards us. And I said, get in that shop. There's a back door. Get off to school. Go on off. She went, no, I can't leave you. I said, you can. I can deal with this. And I thought, I know these girls. I, you know, go to parties with them and they'll be fine. But was I wrong? They came up to me. One girl moved forward from the group and said, huh, now who looks pretty? After having just thrown the eggs and flour at me. And I was wearing this beautiful coat that my mum and dad had just got me. And I was just in shock. And I was like, what? This is how you felt about me all these years. This is your true feelings. Why were you hiding this from me? Anyway, I went back to school, went straight to the headmaster's office because we were being turned out. That was our last day and we were going to be checked off in the classroom, made sure that our desks were tidy and we were looking immaculately. And I obviously couldn't do that. I didn't tell on them. I didn't give the names, but the headmaster ended up calling these people out and said, you better stand up now. And then their parents were called to the school. And anyway, I took all that on board, but I saved that girl. And it's always been my mission to look out for others that can't save themselves.
And also, I mean, let's just look at where you are now, Penny. Where are those bullies now?
We can track them down. They're not here. They're not here.
They are not at the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
No.
At least I hope they're not.
No. Stand up if it's one of you.
Let's really hope they're not.
Miserable swines.
What do you think that that young Penny would make of where you are now?
Penelope, as I was known at school. Well, I often think as well, as from the bullying standpoint, I felt like some of the teachers didn't help either. And there was one teacher, I remember, if I was stood up in the classroom, he would say, Penelope, sit down, you're casting a shadow over the rest of the classroom.
Oh, God.
So everyone else would laugh. So then I was picked on for being tall and skinny. I would wear extra thick tights and stuff a bra just to fill myself out. So I had a lot of, like, body conscious, like, food issues. And when I left school and became a model, I was told I wasn't skinny enough. So I didn't really know where I was there. But, and then there's the dyslexia. My mother and father and I didn't know. The teachers didn't know what it was. You were at school in my day, you were either clever or you were dumb. And so I was pushed to the side, you know. There's no point in focusing on Penelope and others like me. We're just going to focus on the people that learn the way we're teaching them, where we see there's potential. Teachers never saw potential in me. And my dad got me extra English classes after school so that I could, you know, get a little bit head on when it came to sitting the exams, because they terrified me. In fact, I would throw up the night before an exam because I'd be so fearful of it. But that English teacher, my dad didn't tell me at the time, but pulled him aside after one of my lessons and said, you're wasting your time. She'll never make anything of herself.
Oh, Penny, this is actually... Again, we say, where is he?
Yes, exactly. Can you give us an insight into the modelling world? Because, we've done a bit of modelling.
Not as much as I would have liked.
I turned my back on it myself.
Is it as glamorous as it might seem?
Well, everyone sees the finished product, don't they? Whether it's the girls on the runway or the glossy magazines, the beautiful locations that you go on. But there is a bit of a mission when it comes to try and get the job in the first place, because you are scrutinised from head to toe. And I've got hyperhidrosis, which is this sort of excessive sweaty palm thing. I don't know if it came on after I went through the attack on the way to school, whether that my nervous system kind of kicked in there. I'm not sure what set it off, but I've had it forever. I used to have to wear cotton gloves doing my exams because I would wet all the paper. So that was always nerve-wracking for me, standing in front of a camera with these sweaty hands. But putting that aside, it was, you know, oh, her shoulders are too broad, because I was a swimmer when I was younger. Or, you know, believe it or not, her legs are too long. It was they were either perfect or too short, too long. Like, you were never felt like you fitted in anywhere. So you're constantly scrutinising yourself. And I went on ridiculous diets. I even took salt tablets before a photo shoot, because my brother was into weight training. And he said, when you have photographs taken, there's an amount of water retention. So if you take the salt tablets, that reduces that extra fluid on the skin to make you appear skinnier than you are. So I was trying all the tricks. And in the end, I was sort of passing out almost, because, you know, 6'1", with not eating very much, you know, your blood pressure drops and away you go.
And does it slightly upset you that actually it doesn't appear that enough has changed within that industry now? I mean, for starters, Jane alluded to before, you found yourself as a vulnerable young woman being really, really beyond exploited by an older man within the industry. But also that attitude to women's bodies, how you make women appear, it's still there, isn't it? Skinny is what rules in fashion.
Yeah.
And too skinny, actually.
Well, it's a case of we're sort of objects. We're like a coat hanger. And the clothes should just hang and fall off of you. So they don't want your body to interrupt the lines of the clothing. So it is, you know, be as skinny as you can. Obviously, I managed to find an area of work, a niche for myself, and it ended up being sportswear, fitness wear, swimwear, working for Speedo, for instance, and then ultimately lingerie. So I found my path, but it took a long time to get there. But I'm glad I got out of the catwalk and that horrible scrutiny of like being something that I wasn't. Mm.
Can we talk about the lingerie? Because you detail in the book your experiences with Michelle Moan.
Mm.
And again, I would say this is my constant refrain this afternoon. Yeah. Look what's happened to her now.
You just don't want to be in my book, because guess what happens?
No, you do not want to be in Wendy's book. No. But she asked you at the very beginning of Ultimo, which was her push-up bra sensation, to be the model for her brand. And the story that you tell us about how she treated you when you were working for her, so, you know, elements of your contract didn't really materialise and weren't really fulfilled, et cetera, et cetera. It was always on a promise. But then she did this extraordinary thing, didn't she? Can you just remind us of who she replaced you with and what happened?
Yeah, so it was Michelle Moan, a Scottish businesswoman, and her husband had a meeting with myself and my husband. And, of course, his love for Scotland, and her husband was into football, and we had this great meeting. And
just remind people who your husband
yes,
is.
Yes, just in case. Yeah. But that would be that Rod Stewart. And so he was supportive of this idea of, I'd been a seasoned model, modelling swimwear lingerie. So it seemed like the perfect fit. Scottish couple, they supported Celtic. and I was going to be the new face of this brand that apparently were on its knees, and they were in the red, and it was their one last chance to get to be successful and to push forward. And she made lots of promises about if we could succeed together, we would be this perfect duo, and I would not just be the model, but we would become a partnership in crime, sort of thing.
Mm. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Let's just insert the word alleged.
Alleged. And so I signed my first year contract. Yes, the publicity went mad. Rod Stewart's girlfriend, front page, boom, 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 boom. Signed a second year contract. And then it went on very successfully. It was everything Michelle wanted it to be. And then she promised me that although I hadn't been given the fee that I should have been given, that would be rewarded to me the third year, and then we would be this dream team. Well, there I was by the fax machine, as it was then, waiting for this new contract to come through. I was sitting in our house in Los Angeles, and there was no material evidence of this new contract, no email, no phone call, no correspondence. The next thing was the news. It was front page news that Michelle Moan had replaced Rod Stewart's girlfriend, Penny Lancaster, with Rod Stewart's ex-wife, Rachel Hunter. Nothing against Rachel Hunter, but it made my life very difficult because it was in the early years where I was trying to form relationships, build bridges, and work on this blended family. So that was like a bomb that went off.
It is one of the stepping outside the sisterhood moments of all time, I think that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's deliberately done for the headlines.
Deliberately, yeah.
And
it was just reeking with lies and deceit. And as we now know of Michelle, if we didn't know her then, she ended up in government, fast track, recommending during COVID that the government, with the money from the public, give her a big purse of it, so because she had this company that can make all this PPE, and
well, it's gone to use a very technical term here, Penny. Tits up,
tits up, very tits up, very tits up. Yes, because none of that PPE could ever be used. It was 40, and funny enough, that company was owned by her husband.
Right,
but as
we speak, she is still in the House of Lords.
Yes,
perhaps not for very much longer. You've just hinted at some of the
complications of Rod's family tree. And I do think, actually, because the blended family is far from uncommon these days. But by God, I mean, Penny's put the work in, hasn't she? She really has.
Well, I think people...
But you have, and you...
They're intrigued as to how you've managed to do it, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of... Well, like, one of my kind of mottos to moving forward in anything is when someone just assumes something about you when they haven't got to know you. So it's kind of like, just watch me. Just watch this space. Just give me time. And so I am lucky that I'm gifted with lots of patience, and I have empathy, and I have time for people. So, of course, Rod's youngest at the time was only 5. That was a little Liam. And
this is when you met?
This is when we first met. And just skipping forward to just a year ago when he got married, Liam asked my son to be his best man at his wedding. So that kind of like ties it up in a nutshell, doesn't it? But I had to sort of be one Penny. I couldn't be one Penny for Liam, one Penny for his eldest Kimberly, who's 21 or turning 21. So I had the teenage years in between and 3 different mothers to navigate and work with. And at the end of the day, I was a woman that was desperate to have children of my own. Really, that's all I ever wanted to be, was a mother. So I put my love and my efforts into those children. And I thought, if I could just show them that I care and that their father ultimately, surely their happiness for him is what they want. It just slowly but slowly
but worked. If you were to try to advise somebody navigating a similar path, what is your top tip?
Well, don't try and be their best friend. Don't give them advice unless they ask for your advice, which they run to me for now. I mean, I just show you my phone now and all the messages from all the kids, you know, about what's happening at Christmas, Penny, or what's, you know, what do you think of my new boyfriend, or whatever it is, you know, that it's so lovely that... they are so proud for me to be their stepmom, and I'm extremely proud to be theirs. And I always say the best gift that Rod and I could have given to our boys is their siblings, because it's just such a wonderful family unit. But it is just taking your time, not trying to be their friend, as I say, not trying to be their mum, just trying to understand what it's like to be in their shoes, what they might be feeling, which goes right back to the... What might that bully be feeling? What might... Always considering how it is for others, not just like me first kind of thing.
You say in the book that lots of people want to cast you as the woman who tamed Rod Stewart. But actually, I think, you know, given all that you've said there and everything that you write about in the book, you are... I think you're the woman who's really gifted Rod Stewart an extraordinary life, actually, because you have brought together... a lot of things that don't really work out for men who have had lots of different families, do they? In their older age, that can become a really difficult thing to try and manage. So when people say you've tamed him, isn't there a bit of you that just go...
Well, I always prefer to say nurtured him.
Oh...
Like I've nurtured the kids and the family, and just, you know, family has always meant a lot to me, my family, and I've appreciated being so lucky and fortunate to have such supportive mum and dad and my brother. And I just always imagined that I would have this beautiful, loving family, and I ended up in a much, much bigger one. And I knew that it wasn't about taking on a man and having that love between two people. It was encompassing the whole family and loving them all.
We've got to say goodbye to our Times Radio audience now, and then we stay here at the Cheltenham Literature Festival and we can do lots of questions for Penny Lancaster. But could our audience festival say farewell to the Times Radio audience listening at home, and we leave them in the very capable hands of Callum MacDonald.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you so much, Fee and Jane. You can hear more from Penny Lancaster on the Off Air podcast. Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum MacDonald sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: the boss of MI5 says the UK faces the threat of Chinese state operatives every day. And the Institute for Fiscal Studies says Rachel Reeves needs to raise £40 billion in next month's budget. Coming up on Drive, we'll unpack that stark analysis from MI5's Sir Ken McCallum and how that plays into the collapsed China spying trial. We've got the former head of MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove, joining us, and you'll hear from the former head of the diplomatic service, Lord MacDonald. Plus, you can hear my conversation with the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament.
This is Times Radio.
First with the news, here's Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Callum. Good afternoon. The Director General of MI5 says he's felt frustration at the collapse of a case against two men accused of spying for China. Sir Ken McCallum has revealed the Secret Services have foiled a new espionage plot by Beijing in the past week.
MI5 will keep doing what the public would expect of us. Our track record is strong. We've intervened operationally again just in the last week, and we will keep doing so. I am MI5 born and bred. I will never back off from confronting threats to the UK wherever they come from.
He described MI5's action in the China spying case as a strong disruption of a national security threat. MPs have announced a formal inquiry into the case after the government released key witness statements which warned of China's large-scale espionage. The Criminal Cases Review Commission says it has referred post office convictions based on evidence from a second accounting software to the Court of Appeal for the first time. The post office used Capture before it moved to the faulty Horizon software. The Chancellor says she is confident that inflation, which was 4.1% in August, will get back to the Bank of England's 2% target.
We do currently have the highest inflation in the G7, but it is a long way off the inflation that we saw under the previous government, where it went above 11%. But do we need to do more to bring down inflation? Absolutely we do, and we're working closely with the Bank of England to make sure that that inflation comes down back to target at 2% and where it is forecast to get over the next year or so.
Rachel Reeves insists high inflation is a global phenomenon when questioned about whether her budget measures had pushed up prices. A prominent economic think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, has warned the Chancellor she needs to raise taxes or cut spending to the tune of £40 billion next month if she's going to avoid further tax rises in future years. A White House official says Donald Trump will speak to Vladimir Putin today. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is due to visit Washington, D.C. tomorrow to try to get more support for his war effort against Russia. Nestlé says it will cut around 16,000 jobs worldwide over the next 2 years. The food and drink company says it will automate more of its processes to cut costs. It currently employs 7,500 people in the UK. And one of the 3,000 people suing the pharmaceutical company Johnson & Johnson over its talcum powder has told Times Radio her cancer diagnosis has completely changed her life. Annabelle Hill is being treated for ovarian cancer. She's part of a lawsuit which says Johnson & Johnson knowingly sold baby powder contaminated with asbestos.
After being diagnosed, I obviously had major surgery, 8 hours, lots of tissue and internal organs removed. And I have been told that the legal team have already asked for some of those samples to be taken away and analysed. From what I gather, it's quite possible that there will be signs of asbestos or certainly talcum powder in my internal organs, which potentially cause the ovarian cancer.
Johnson & Johnson's owners insist the powder met standards and did not cause cancer. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four on Thursday afternoon, the 16th of October. This is Callum MacDonald with Drive on Times Radio. Thank you so much for joining me while John Pienaar has today off. We've spent the day then poring over witness statements published by the government to help us understand why a case involving two men accused of spying for China collapsed. Those two men both deny wrongdoing, but the political row continues. A former director of public prosecutions has already told Times Radio today that it's difficult to understand why the trial did not proceed and that the witness statements we've now all seen were more than adequate to use at a trial. We'll hear from another former DPP shortly to establish whether these expert lawyers are in agreement. The lawyer's consternation comes after the publication of the witness statements of a civil servant, the Deputy National Security Advisor, which are clear that the Chinese are carrying out spying operations against the UK. So why could these not fuel a prosecution? MPs will now begin a formal inquiry, they say, as soon as possible. And the realities of the political dilemma have been laid bare again today by the boss of MI5, who's revealed that another espionage threat was disrupted this week. Just a few days ago, it was confirmed that a Chinese company will invest £1.5 billion in the UK's largest wind turbine manufacturing facility to be based in Scotland. The Chinese embassy, for its part, based in London, has criticised British politicians' attempts to, quote, smear and defame China. Speaking of which, by the way, Stephen Swinford from The Times reports the decision on the new secretive super embassy approval will now be delayed until December the 10th. Can the UK cut ties with China in this increasingly fragmented world? Should the UK cut ties with China? China's impact on the UK, its infiltration of society, seems to be pervasive. We know that, don't we? We're witnessing it in real time in these last few weeks. But as Stephen Swinford, political editor of The Times, writes today, it feels like what we know today, right now, is the tip of the iceberg. By 7pm on Times Radio, we are striving to know more. This is Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Let's start by looking at these latest events then in this continuing spy scandal. Conservative Shadow Minister Neil O'Brien raised an urgent question in the House of Commons this morning. He says the government is now tying itself in knots.
We can now see that the two witness statements from this year did state the position of the current Labour government. A direct contradiction of what the Prime Minister said yesterday. And the evidence includes lines from Labour's manifesto. They weaken the case. It makes it less clear that China is a threat to our national security.
Cabinet Office Minister Chris Ward responded with the government's position.
It's clear from this evidence, which all can now see, that the DNSA took significant strides to articulate the threat from China in support of the prosecution. The decision to proceed, as the Prime Minister made clear yesterday, was taken purely by the CPS. It is also clear that the three statements are constrained by the position of the Conservative government on China at the time of the alleged offences. Mr. Speaker, as the Security Minister said on Monday and the Prime Minister said yesterday, this government's first priority will always be national security and keeping this country safe. We wanted this case to proceed. I'm sure all members of the House did, and I know you did too, Mr. Speaker. We are all profoundly disappointed it did not.
Well, Labour MP Matt Western chairs the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy and has